I said that Biden was a lot like Trump, which made me sound like a post-leftist maybe, but I want to talk about how the post-left ideology needs to be rejected, even as some of the attitudes that you might see on the post-left should be embraced. So so that's what I want to bring up in the Parrot Room, and I'm going to bring it up here at the end, but this will also be clipped out and put at the beginning to give everyone a double whammy of join us in the Parrot Room.
Did you read the Keynesian International one?
No, I just read the Matic.
Okay,
Roosevelt's the New Deal.
Well, the other one's a Matic too, but we can do that after. We'll come back to it after the E.P. Thompson Kolakowski debate, because it'll actually kind of tie them both in. So,
well, remind me of who Paul Matic is, because we're going to be talking about this essay, Roosevelt's New Deal, in this episode. So, I mean, I know about Paul Matic a little bit, but I had to look at his Wikipedia entry to remind myself. I don't know, maybe my memory's going early onset dementia or something, but remind everybody who he is or who he was.
So Paul Matic was a council communist generally associated with the left communist tradition in America. He also was one of the few people in America who was a pretty strong disciple of Henrik Grossman. Even though they didn't directly ever work together, Grossman was not a left communist. Grossman was, you know, more in the Austro-Marxist and slightly Stalinist adjacent tradition. Matic had a similar analysis of capitalism that, you know, the tendency of the rate of profit to fall was not linear, but it was real. And there were countervailing tendencies. And he thought that most of their countervailing tendencies had been tapped out in the late 30s. In later writings, he attributes the revival of capital to a few things, the biggest one being both the simultaneous removal of surplus population, to put it in a term of art, and the crisis and destruction of
capital.
Yeah, of capital. Of overproduced capital. And one of the best ways to, you know, to handle overproduction while maintaining full war economy is to blow shit up. I mean, you know, I don't just mean that like blowing capital up, but when you're producing capital for war, most of it's gonna get destroyed, even if, you know, you were fairly successful. So from the standpoint of avoiding an overproduction crisis while operating at full industrial capacity, a war is actually pretty good as long as you're not also being attacked and having your infrastructure destroyed. And, you know, usually you are. The United States is one of those rare instances where that doesn't happen. And so we kind of were able to prove how useful it was for us as a way to get rid of overdeveloped capital. But in 1939, when we're looking...
Oh, I just want to interject, actually. when you're talking about overproduction, are you talking about how the commodities you're producing are getting cheaper and cheaper because of the innovations in technology and the increase of mass production, even as your initial investment and the value of the fixed capital remains... maybe it, you know, isn't devalued. You've already paid for it. You've already accrued debt based on it.
You're talking about that plus literal, just you're driving your prices down by flooding the market with commodities. So both things are actually happening, according to Matic, or Matic. So before we, I guess we can talk about this a little bit. I should remind people there are two Paul Maddox, Paul Maddox Jr., who is also a communist. But Paul Maddox Sr. Devoted a lot of his later writings on debating Keynesianism as an answer for this. And he started worrying about it in the late 1930s, because he saw all this potential in what he called inflationary spending policies were becoming part of all the major powers' actual ways to address production crises. It wasn't just the United States, but you had a major uptick in that in the U.S. The reason why I wanted us to read this now is because, and then in another episode, we'll probably talk about the companion piece I want us to eventually read, because it'll really clarify things. When you look at the New Deal, it does do a lot of things. I was talking to a friend of mine yesterday about how during the New Deal, you saw, as a proportion of GDP, government spending go up from between 1 or 2% to like 6%. All right. But that outside of the WPA and public investments, the New Deal really isn't what it's painted as contemporaneously. Like, people seem to paint it as a social democratic program, and it's really not. And I guess when we get into the article, we can talk about that a little bit, but what you see is an increase in government spending, a little bit through inflation, most of it actually going into the private sector, with the WPA kind of forming a stopgap and investing in public infrastructure, but paying wages that were actually slightly below market price.
What do people think they mean when they say it was a social democratic policy?
For one, they see the end of the Depression and think about the Truman Eisenhower post-war compact, which they see as an extension of New Deal policies. In fact, usually you'll hear people talk about, the New Deal era as going from 32 all the way into, let's say,
Carter.
Some people think it ends at Nixon, although I find that kind of weird. But at least until Lyndon Johnson, and probably until Carter. But what they tend to do is project Great Society and post-war social compact programs, four-point programs, back into the past, and underestimate how much that government spending was actually aimed at businesses, frankly. And the Fordist compact. So the idea was that if you would invest in businesses, they would pay more to keep their consumers up. And this led to a lot of things that we deal with now. I mean, you think about the tax incentives passed for employer provided insurance. That's a Fordist policy, There's all sorts of little tweaks like that that began being done in the 50s. There were other forms of direct investment, but mostly actually into things like rebuilding Europe and the Marshall Plan. And unlike the way this is framed now, while that wasn't funded on deficit spending, it was funded on very high marginal gains tax. Which there was an increasing push to lower by the end of the 1950s. And JFK did. I sometimes joke that JFK is actually, the proto-neoliberalizer as far as America goes, because the first time you really see massive cuts in taxation and in social welfare spending. Although those are not as massive as they will be later. The cuts in taxation are justified because supposedly we no longer need to rebuild Europe after the war. And this is something that Paul Maddox Sr. actually predicted would happen in the early 50s. So I think he's very interesting because he goes against what the consensus is now on even sort of the Marxist adjacent left. And I think that's a real problem when you have a high nostalgia for the New Deal, particularly when you don't really seem to know what it is and what its aims were. And there are people who should know better, who perpetuate this myth about the New Deal. And what I find interesting about this Roosevelt's New Deal article is that it's pretty clear that in 1939, before the war, the dividends paid off by the New Deal were beginning to dry up. And voluntary suppression of labor action was also beginning to lead to frustrations. But the workers' movement was so tied into the Democratic Party, partially because of the kind of coalition that was built in the you know, first and second years of the first and second years of FDR's administration, which included, you know, I mean, it included like people from the broadly speaking American socialist adjacent tradition, like Henry Wallace, who, you know, was ran as a Progressive Party candidate and really did support a lot of like social democratic policies, wanted to kind of pit back up on Reconstruction, wanted to break up things in the Jim Crow South. There's a lot of stuff. And of course, he's marginalized from the administration out of fears of being considered red, and Truman replaces him. So there were, that was being funneled into that also. By this point, the SPA was very, very weak. And the CIO was beginning to look towards combining with the AFL, but that had not happened yet. Mm-hmm. And so you saw a kind of intentional self-tamping down of worker militancy. Plus, there was this idea of unemployed cooperatives that were encouraged by actually the Democratic Party, and this is actually kind of forgotten about, but they were not allowed to engage in strikes in any way, nor, you know, if they were in temp labor or whatever, they couldn't strike for it. They were only allowed to organize and to try to bargain, kind of like the way a lot of like state employee unions actually work in red states. Mm-hmm. To try to bargain down the temporary work for, you know, to put pressure on employers. But since there was such a high demand for work and a low demand for labor, that really wasn't that effective. And by agreeing not to strike, they really didn't have a whole lot they could do. I think it's actually part of why we don't really remember them, and they don't really come up in a lot of people's like hagiography of the New Deal. Mm. And Matic talks about that as well.
Is it Matic or Matic?
It's Matic. I'm probably butchering it. It's Matic because it's Paul Matic Jr. is Matic. Got it. So we'll just say Matic.
Matic. Well, just from what I remember from just having read the essay, the things that struck me the most were that Matic talks about how the policies in the New Deal had the same aim as the policies of the Hoover era, mm-hmm. beforehand, that FDR and Hoover didn't have different aims. They just had a different approach. The Hoover approach was, let's see if I can find it. He said, they wanted directly to lower wages and cause deflation.
Yeah, it was the choice between deflationary policies and inflationary policies.
Right.
So
you lower wages through both through deflation, but you also lower prices that way.
Right.
And then you also intervene with spending. And the New Deal approach was the opposite, which is to lower wages through inflation and to increase productivity as well, with the aim of lowering wages and prices both.
Yeah, right. But by theoretically increasing demand. So let's be a little bit more technical on
this.
It's
not really only just by increasing demand, because the demand for workers' goods are going to remain mostly static. It's by increasing the rate of production, by having more labor involved and increasing the hours worked per day. You're increasing the surplus, therefore you can reduce the prices per unit, and that means you can pay your workers less because their consumer goods are going to go down. That's what I took from
right.
And then you add inflation into the deflation into the mix as well, and so you can also pay less because the prices are going down.
So we need to explain this though in conventional economic terms, just so people understand that if you're raising wages, but waging them raising them slower than inflation. Are you just keeping them stagnant?
Yeah, but I'm talking about Hoover first.
Right.
Deflation now.
The deflationary theory is you push wages down deliberately. You encourage businesses to keep workers, but to keep workers by slashing their salaries.
Right. You're right. You know what? I would gone to the inflation. You were right to talk about inflation. Let's go back to that. Say that again.
So the inflation theory, it looks like you're not lowering workers' wages as much or at all, depending on how things are going. But the theory goes that if you build up liquidity and wages stay static or they drop a little bit, but this liquidity increase, causes inflation and prices go up, it stimulates, production by pseudo stimulating demand. Actually, the idea is if you produce, the demand will increase. I don't want to say supply side because that means something else after the 1980s, but it's based on increasing the supply of products for people to buy and hoping that there's enough slack in the economy if enough people are working to absorb the extra production. But there's in a down economy, there's a limit to that. But effectively, either way, what you're actually doing is lowering purchasing power. And one I dare to say is kind of honest, whereas the other hides, that your wages are actually dropping, even though people more or less know it. But if you look at when there is an inflation spike, people don't think, I got a raise this year. And stuff costs more. In the moment, you don't think I'm actually making less money. And it takes a while and several years of that accruing for it to be really noticed. And that's been a U.S. policy during the 30s. It's also been U.S. policy since the 80s. And that gap has been filled in by consumer debt and consumer debt caused by corporate debt from the central bank being at an extremely low interest rate, which it now has been for 30 years. I mean, we're approaching zero. So, and we've been there for a while. So I point that out because it's also, there's this idea that the New Deal is somehow radically different from neoliberalism. And in some ways, in regards to like how you set up markets and what the government's doing, it is. But in other ways, it's actually not. Because you're using inflation, you are having a government stopgap that involves a lot of government expenditure through deficit spending on infrastructure. But so that's different. but you're also doing a lot of that by giving private companies government contracts.
You're not demarketizing anything. Yeah, he talks about the WPA is producing scabs, and I want to get to that. But here's, I found the section I was thinking of. Can I read this?
Yeah, go ahead.
So if one pays no attention to his ruler's words, but looks only at their actions, he will soon discover that the present administration, like any past or future administration of capitalist character, defends no particular philosophical principle, but is solely engaged in helping to make possible greater profits and in participating in the enjoyment of these profits sweated out of the workers. Different methods are proposed for that purpose. Some capitalist groups favor deflationary methods to bring this about. That is, they want to solve the problem by direct wage cuttings, saving expenditures, and by leaving the business revival entirely to the supposedly automatic workings of the market, which would lead to the elimination of incapable capitalists and to a greater profitability for the surviving capitalist groups. Other capitalists are more interested in inflationary methods as a shortcut to better profits. They favor increasing governmental interference. They are quite ready to force out of existence undesirable capitalist elements and to cut wages in the roundabout way of raising prices by prevailing wages. The Hoover administration represented the first group and method. Any other party wishing for power in 1933 had to express the opposite idea. And that brought the Roosevelt landslide. So the key here is that whereas Hoover would directly cut wages, as you said, in a more more honest way, and create deflation, which would save on expenditures, would mean that if you're investing in capital or buying new equipment or paying rents, that all that would, the price of those things would go down under deflation. And then you would allow businesses that weren't doing well to go under. That would, lead to greater profitability is the idea. And the Roosevelt era did the opposite of that, meaning that they created inflation, so they didn't have to directly cut wages, but they also would force out of existence the capitalist elements that weren't working, and interfere in them. But they would also interfere in the market.
Mm-hmm.
More directly, and he emphasizes, and we can go to this now, maybe the way they interfered in the labor market, the market for wages, and the way they did that was by controlling the amount of aid and the wages of the WAP workers, which then drove down the real wages.
Yeah, the backstop was set so low that it was not a backstop to increase wages. Like when you talk about a jobs guarantee now, this is like a jobs guarantee that the state jobs are like paying half of minimum wage effectively, but there isn't minimum wage in the 30s. So that's not a consideration. So there's nothing to see as like the baseline bottom bulwark. You can pretty much pay what people can accept. So while it may have made the situation better, There are ways in which there are real debates both at the time and ever since about like how much this policy they went on about actually stopped the Great Depression from being like the Long Depression, the 1870s through the 1890s. And there is a real sense of that. There's also a sense that like the Roosevelt administration was willing to actually cut into the wealth of the rich in a way that we have not seen since the 1950s. It's still very interesting to look at from the standpoint that you're talking about, because the WPA jobs effectively do create scab jobs, because there's now like the people in the WPA jobs want
real jobs.
Yeah, they want private sector jobs because the WPA jobs don't pay as well.
Right. They're surviving, always threatening to take a job from whoever has a private sector job. Right. And so that gives the private sector the ability to not worry about conditions and to lower wages even.
So the WAP effectively creates a backstop against total social reproduction crisis. So instead of having to raise wages or actually deal with this whole crisis, the WAP steps in, effectively creates a two-tiered system, because there's also a ton of people waiting to get WPA jobs. I'm saying WAP. WPA jobs.
Sorry, did I keep saying WAP?
No, I think I've been saying it. I'll restate this so you can cut this cleanly. So what happens is this. As you were describing, you have the market-based wage, and then you have these WPA jobs that are lower, and then you have a mass of people trying to get those on a backlist. So in all sectors,
and they're getting benefits, right? They're getting like relief. Mm-hmm. Aid. They're getting aid. They're not getting nothing. They're getting
right.
They're not working in the black market. They're still in the labor pool.
Right. There is relief going to them. Although, again, not a lot. So
less than the WPA jobs provided.
Right.
Yeah.
So what you have is a way for businesses to maintain profitability, because it's driving, in a way, it's actually, instead of serving as a backstop to bulwark the working class, which you would think a jobs guarantee would do if it's set, you know, at market wages, it would. Mm-hmm. But since it's lower than that, what it does is kind of give it actually, in a way, gives a means of a pressure valve so you can keep wages somewhat low to return profitability. That's kind of the idea, by the government being the backstop and doing the stimulus spending. And then there's also a huge demand for labor, because you have these three tiers of like severity of relations, right? Mm-hmm. But what it does do is it stops a black market from forming, and it stops a total social reproduction crisis, which, you know, is like the Grossmanite perfect model, where you just see profits drop to nothing and unemployment rages really, really fast, and you have social instability. Particularly with highly communalized workers, that would lead to, in theory, organization. And this, right.
If
this
you're getting
stops
relief,
happening.
If you're getting relief and you're, or you get to have a WPA job, you're, it's in your interest to struggle to get it to the ring, to the rung above you. Mm. Like if you are on relief, you want to survive on that relief for as long as you can until you can get a WPA job. Rather than organize and rock the boat and possibly get a social stigma so you can never get to that next rung.
Right.
Right.
The Works Progress Administration was like that. I mean, and, you know, in my own family life, my great-grandfather shot himself during this time period because he pissed off somebody in the WPA and was effectively blacklisted. Okay. That's the legend of my family. I mean, I don't have hard proof of it, but he did die in 1934, I think. So, you know, this created an interesting thing, though, because the areas were so immiserated, and particularly, actually, when we talk about regional immiseration, the South had never recovered from the Civil War, like, economically speaking, between, it had been used as first agricultural and then textile labor. And I don't know what people who are listening to us know about textile labor, but usually you judge where textiles are as the shittiest place to work in an economic system. So, you know, where are they made now? Bangladesh. You had textile mills in the South, so they were desperate. And this actually led to this interesting coalition for the Democrats, because you had these Dixiecrats who were socially conservative. They were segregationists. They considered themselves a party of the Civil War South and of the Confederacy. And then you had these progressive Democrats in the North who saw themselves as part of the progressive movement. But the progressive movement was not partisan until the FDR administration. it had been a bipartisan movement during the teens and 20s, because it was kind of its first instantiation in the executive was Teddy Roosevelt, a Republican. So that desperation actually was part of Roosevelt's base.
Teddy Roosevelt.
No, Franklin Roosevelt's base, because it was able to keep both Dixiecrats, and because it was seen, because these WPA jobs are not highly discriminatory towards Black people. They were discriminatory. They just weren't as much. They provided them. It flipped the Black vote from Republican to Democrat, and that has remained ever since then, actually, in the South. So it built Roosevelt was able, by doing this, to build a coalition. But it was it was not just a cross racial coalition. It was also a cross class coalition, because a lot of these areas, like the South, had depended on agrarian labor and these textile mills, was able to use this kind of to keep wages flat. And so while it looked progressive, what it actually more or less led to was just a stalemate. And you could argue, and many people will, that when you listen to liberals talk about this now, that this was good because the Depression could have been worse. It could have been the Long Depression, even though, like, I don't think most people really know anything about the Long Depression in the United States, unfortunately, even though it very much affected us. Mm. And that it is true that the bourgeoisie and the upper middle classes actually paid equally to the proletariat in cost in this depression, which was absolutely not true in the 19th century depression cycles, where, because there was no government intervention, basically, you had the increasing centralization of wealth and the beginning, the monopolization of capital. So what you have with this is you still have the monopolization of capital, right? You have increasing, you're getting rid of all these deadweight small firms, but what even though you're also kind of, if someone gets too big, you'll trust bust them, but there's an upper end limit too, but you're making the market more efficient, tending it towards centralization, while you're also not allowing all the wealth to accrue and hoarding like had happened in the Long Depression. And I think that's part of why, like, liberals sort of like it when they look at it from just on paper stats, like, without really looking at what it did to the labor dynamics.
Did those policies, the taxation, increase productive investment, or did it just have the political consequences of helping to control the working classes?
It's actually very hard to disaggregate that. I've been looking at the stats all day after reading this to try to see if I could figure it out, because Maddock doesn't talk about it. What I will say, from what I can figure out, is more or less, it might have for 1 or 2 years in the early 30s. But by 1937, it had already started to die off.
In other words, instead of paying taxes, you would invest.
Right.
Right. Because you couldn't just hoard your cash or financialize it.
Right.
So you would invest. And that I can see how that might be a consequence of a high rate of taxation on capital or on private profit. But I've always been, indoctrinated with the idea that what really solved the Great Depression was what Maddox said, which is that the destruction of capital and the surplus people. One thing that I couldn't help think about as we were talking about this is the effect of some of the policies of the progressive Democrats, what they would likely be if we believe Maddock today. Like, if you had a UBI, universal basic income, and some sort of massive jobs program. But one like the Biden administration is setting up, in other words, small wage increases and the expansion of money for, let's say, care workers.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So you have, then you would have a situation where you'd have sort of this barely subsistence wage given out to the unemployed through UBI, that it would be survival level. Right.
Yeah. I mean, if it's like what we're talking about right now, like what this tax credit for families, which is the only thing that actually gotten through, you're not even at not quite survival level, but let's say that they were able to keep something like, unemployment supplements in most states. I'm in a state that's already turning it down, although we also have very low unemployment. We're only at like 2%. Mm-hmm. And for those of you who don't know, I live in Utah. Can you really survive off of $300 extra off of whatever your state gets already from the unemployment tax? Because some of those states are not very generous. So like, you know, some of them are more generous than others. I doubt it. And I don't think there's a single state where, you know, unemployment you could replicate even. You would have a hard time replicating even a poverty wage off of unemployment without significant. But, you know, with the $300 a month, I think the $300 a month. And a lot of states, it was more than enough to actually be above the minimum wage. So what does that mean? I mean, it means a lot of what you're saying, and that seems to be kind of what they're doing. I mean, it's interesting when you hear MMT and neo-Keynesian proponents of like jobs guarantees. What they tell you it's going to be is at the market wage, and what it almost always is lower. Because the moment, let's take these care workers. You do a care workers administration. I think if the government paid for hourly care work for all who might qualify for it, just looking at the stats of the elderly, at $15 an hour, like that would be
a lot of money.
I've seen estimates of like up to $4 trillion a year. Wow. You know, like those might be inflated. I don't know, but it's a lot. Because the reason why it would be, I think the $4 trillion a year is also assuming that that's a composite. That's not just the.
But you don't do that. See, you talk about the most marginalized communities only, along racial lines and geographic lines. So you're not going to be targeting everyone. You're going to be selectively targeting the most impoverished. Means testing. However you want to do it. So then you can spend a lot less money.
Well, I think Adolf Fried said very clearly that if you did that and also let precarious communities and non-precarious areas are amongst the majority population, you have a racial resentment machine, you know, there that would be very hard to tap down or argue against. And I don't, you know, he said this in an argument about reparations. This is not even reparations level stuff.
But the thing about it is that all you're talking about is a small sliver. It's not even like for the whole Black population or all the impoverished Black people in America. It's for the care workers.
Yeah, but who are theoretically actually educated.
Right.
And
who are in impoverished areas. So you're talking about, I guess, mostly Black and Hispanic women.
If you actually, if you do it by zip code and not by race, which I think is what you'd have to legally do ultimately. Frankly, I think if it was truly racially tested, I think the Supreme Court would strike it down, pretty quickly.
Yeah.
But, if you tie, I think you could tie it to like we do with education funding, like you can tie it to the zip code and, zip code is a proxy for race. But even with that, like, it would go to a lot of poor white people, because there are plenty of poor white areas. It's it's a proportionality issue more than a raw numbers issue. What I would say though, you're still talking about like maybe 3-4% of the population with that one program. The idea is that it has multiplier effects. It stimulates consumer spending, and that would stimulate more local jobs. And in some ways, I've been calling it like anemic neo-Fordism. It's not the same as Fordism. It's nowhere nearly as actually ambitious as 50s Fordism. And we could talk about that a little bit. But it's kind of an anemic, half-assed way to do it, because there is a sense in which the United States could actually handle a fair amount of inflation and inflationary pressures, although there are complications to that we're already seeing.
Haven't we mostly experienced deflation?
Not right now.
Not yet. I thought we did during the first year.
We did during the first 9 months. We've actually seen a spike in sectoral inflation that is now carried over the general consumer prices. Okay. So we now have real inflation. The way that I've heard like Axios and Vox say that it's only sectional inflation with a little bit of spillover from all the QE that was done, but it's just going to wash away in a year or so. Probably it might lead to a while of like slightly elevated inflation. So instead of the target 3% that we have per year, we have a it'll be like 4% a year or whatever. That compounds though really fast, because we also have to remember that interest rates are basically at nothing. So savings rates are basically at nothing. And there's also not a lot of incentive to invest. What I think the Biden administration seems to be thinking it can do is, because we've seen these declines in any investment except in stocks, which have been radically inflated by QE, I think everybody agrees with that now, and which have led to an expansion of rentier relations. So what have people started to do with all this excess QE, you know, all this inflated stocks? Well, if people think the stocks are bubbling, they're gonna diversify their basket, right, if you're a capitalist. So you also don't think there's a lot of productive, things to invest in outside of like, it's a good time to invest in medicine because the government's actually enabling rent seeking indirectly through taxation or printing money, depending on what you think the Biden administration is going to do about it. But what you do see is this tendency to start investing in property. So a lot of, there's been a kind of equalization of the hyperinflated housing markets spilling out into the other cities in the United States. Now it's spilling out everywhere. Like there's a general housing boom because we've been understocked for a while. There's also sectional vehicle and labor and lumber shortage because there was an overproduction and hoarding of wood, but no milling. So there's a backstop there. So you've seen a lot of things go up dramatically. Some of that is just supply chain sectional malfeasance, But in housing, that leads a double bind. We already had a housing problem before COVID. The stocks were never replenished for average people after the 2007-2008 recession. The only building have really been in luxury homes. Cities have been encouraging the building of mid-price housing in some regions, I know around here, but mid-price housing is still assuming median wage of like 50 to 60 K a year. So it's not super attainable. And so you have all these problems, and now you have all this flood of unstable inflated capital, and people want to at least backstop it a little bit in case the QE ever runs out or Biden gets really, really pissy on these issues. And so what it's led to is a lot of speculative buying of property and speculative selling of property at high rates. That is going to spill to the general economy eventually, because it's going to even drive business rents up. And this leads to a kind of interesting situation where, like, we've had this major crash in the economy. We have not been hit as bad as actually you would think for as long as we would shut down. I mean, I've read that 25% of American families saw significant decreases in income. And there has been a lot of unemployment, particularly of women. There's also a whole lot of people who are close to retirement age, and a whole lot of women who've just decided, at least for now, they're out of the labor market. And not to mention, you know, 500,000 people died. So, I mean, that does have some effect. Mm-hmm. And that would normally lead to an increase in wages, right?
Because most of those people, not to be jaded, but weren't most of those people outside of the labor market?
No.
No?
No.
Okay.
Because while it did disproportionately hit people over 75, it also disproportionately hit poor people. So there is a sweet spot of, like, you were be particularly vulnerable for COVID is you're an elderly person who still goes to work. Now, I actually don't know. When I say no, I think it did hit more people who don't work than didn't, but it didn't not hit this category of, like,
and so it did affect how many people are struggling for jobs.
Right.
After.
Right. But it would have only affected it on margin. So the big thing seems to be a lot of people have just decided, who were close to retirement age, seem to just be like, well, I had to retire for a year, I'm just done. There's also been all these tendencies for the last 10 years to push back the age of fully entering into the labor market. I think I've read that the average full-time employment really begins for most people who are younger than me at 28. So, wow. I mean, so, like, there's a lot of part-time and gig employment before then, but like Zoomers and younger millennials have not been entering the labor market in mass numbers anyway, at least not at full capacity, not at full employment for themselves. So we would call them underemployed in the old parlance, right? It might have been 27, but it's way higher, because, like, when I was coming out of college, it was like 22 was normal, and most people had a high school job. And high school jobs are actually becoming very rare. And, you know, there's been this push towards increased credentialization. And then there's just been massive amounts of gig work that people do for years and years until they can land their first full-time job. And, you know, they'll be driving Uber and working, you know, as a barista and whatever else.
Are people taking longer and longer to leave the labor market too?
Yes. Yes.
I think
I think this year ended that. That's what I'm trying to indicate.
Well, maybe, but here's a little anecdote. When I went to get my, I don't know if I may have already told you this story, but when I went to get my COVID shot the first time, I got an Uber, and my Uber driver was 88 years old. And he had been a trucker for 60 years or more. And he said he retired 5 years earlier, but he decided he wanted to keep active, so he was an Uber driver.
Well, I wonder how the gig economy actually affects this, because they're considered contractors. There's a way in which the stats are juked more than normal, but in ways that are actually hard to read, because how do you count contractors in employment? Usually count them as employed, but, you know, okay. There's all this talk of a labor shortage, and unemployment is really low right now, but it looks like we're seeing other forms of stagnation. So, despite unemployment, wages still aren't really going up. Jobs that we thought we were going to lose, a lot of people were going to quit and enter the general economy, like teaching, where there was like massive concern. There was actually less teachers who quit in most states this year than before. Not just the states that stayed at home, like here in Utah, where I think something like 95% of teachers were in class. We had less teachers quitting. However, if what I hear from my school and the unions, as soon as it's seen as a viable opportunity for a lot of people, that will reverse. So a lot of people are just holding off now, leaving a job they resent. It's hard to say what it all means. The beginning of signs of inflation, though, is worrying for a lot of Democrats, because there has been the assumption of the last two decades by both Democrats and Republicans that significant inflation is pretty much impossible. We have the productive capacity to eat up all but 2 or 3% of what we're doing per year. And the 2 or 3% is actually not even that bad. It's not even that bad for the working class, even though it's bad for savings, because working class people don't have the stuff to save anyway. And they're so debt leveraged that 3% inflation, once you compare that with debt, doesn't balance it out, but at least makes it, it keeps it from being even more onerous than it would already be. Particularly when interest rates are fairly low. I say all this to say that there's a lot of ways in which, in some ways I would say something that may infuriate our progressive friends.
Hopefully all of this has infuriated them. But
yeah. Ahead. There's a lot of ways in which Biden is a lot like FDR, but there are ways that are pernicious. And watching the left, even the socialist left, drop their opposition to the centrist Democrats because they're experimenting with very weak forms of prior, like, Fordist tinkering in the economy, which is a reversal of neoliberal tinkering. I mean, like, the one thing I will tell people is everybody thinks neoliberalism is, you know, all government non-intervention, laissez-faire. That's absolutely not true. It's non-regulatory, but that's not the same thing as laissez-faire. The government's always compelling markets where there even weren't any. You're seeing that people realize that that whole return the profitability after the 70s that the neoliberal project seemed to produce is both super shallow, and it's been shallow actually kind of the entire time, but also it's not paying dividends anymore. It's lasted about as long as high Keynesianism, classical high Keynesianism lasted. It's gone through a generational cycle. It survived like four business cycles, but every business cycle, the recovery gets longer and longer. And it's hard to see where this goes right now, particularly when, like, yes, there's talk about raising the minimum wage to $15, but then they can't get it through. Plus, when you actually do inflation-adjusted purchase power adjustment, the fight for 15 should be the fight for 22, because we've been at the fight for 15 for $7 more of inflation. And so rolling that over 4 years, by the time it be done, it should really be like the fight for $26 or $27 of inflation is at pre-COVID rates. Mm-hmm. So, but yes. So what you also saw during the beginning of the COVID is a little bit of deflation that's over. And so
I jump in? All right. What I want to say is, two things. And actually I may cut this part out and, inserted at the beginning, which is that I said that Biden was a lot like Trump, which made me sound like a post-leftist maybe, but I want to talk about how the post-left ideology needs to be rejected, even as some of the attitudes that you might see on the post-left should be embraced. Mm-hmm. So that's what I want to bring up in the Parrot Room, and I'm going to bring it up here at the end, but this will also be clipped out and put at the beginning to give everyone a double whammy of join us in the Parrot Room. Thanks for watching this Zero Books video. If you enjoyed it, subscribe to this channel and click on the notifications bell so that you'll be alerted whenever we release a new video. You should also consider supporting us on Patreon. Our patrons get access to our Inside Zero Books podcast every week and can get access to the Zero Books Book Club and help us to continue making online content from the left.